Hi there, welcome to Victim to Victor, the podcast dedicated to empowering abuse survivors and inspiring healing, hope, and positive change. I'm Anu Verma, a published author, and in every episode, I'll sit down with a guest and embark on an insightful conversation about trauma, as well as practical strategies to start the healing process. So let's get started. I hope you enjoy the show. And with me today, I have Ari Schoenbrunn. Ari is a 9/11 survivor turned author, speaker, podcast host, and executive performance coach. He was a chief administrative officer of Cantor Fitzgerald & Co., one of the world's leading financial service firms, and he was on the 78th floor of Tower 1 when the first plane hit the World Trade Center on September the 11th, 2001. He helps a colleague suffering third-degree burns to safety and was thrown into the national spotlight thereafter. His miraculous first-hand account about survival has been retold in newspapers, magazines, broadcast outlets, and books. Mr. Schoenbrunn is a renowned inspirational speaker and the author of Miracles and Fate on 78. He draws from the personal heartbreak he endured during the devastation of 9/11, deftly weaving in his capital markets expertise after more than three decades of working on Wall Street. Mr. Schoenbrunn is a native New Yorker and is passionate about philanthropy and serves as a board member of Strength to Strength, a global non-profit organization that works with victims of terror across the world. And here is our wonderful Ari, all the way from New York. How are you, Ari?
Wonderful, Anu. Thank you so much for having me.
Oh, it's an absolute honor. Thank you so much for coming on the Victim to Victor podcast. And you have a real interesting and a story of survival to share, which I'm really excited to have you on to inspire my listeners with. So thank you so much.
Oh, you're quite welcome. I hope I can do it justice.
Absolutely, absolutely. As you know, this is a podcast aimed for survivors of trauma. And you've undergone some significant trauma in your life, and it'd be great for you to share with my listeners more about yourself, you know, who you are, what you've done, and your story, please.
Sure, absolutely. I spent the better part of my working life on Wall Street. I don't know how many years, 35, 40 years, something like that. My life changed on September 11th of 2001. When I was on the 78th floor of Tower 1 when that first plane hit. We're going to get into that story. But my life changed on that day, and I became a totally different person, a totally new person. And I'll give your audience a little taste of what that day was all about for me. It was 20 to 7 in the morning. I had my briefcase over my shoulder, had my cup of coffee in my hands. I yelled up to my wife, bye, hon, love, see ya. I yelled up to my kids, bye, kids, have a great day in school. And I started to walk out the door. This was on Tuesday, September 11th. And my wife yells down to me, she says, did you do Baruch's book order? Now, Baruch is my third child. He was 8 years old at the time. And I learned something very important that day. Teachers have a wonderful way of torturing parents. It's called the Scholastic Book Order. I'm sure you have that in the UK, because I'm pretty sure it's all over the world, where they, you know, the teachers hand out these little pamphlets and the kids have to pick books, and, right?
Yeah.
Well, my son was no different than any other eight-year-old, and he wanted like all the games and all the books, whatever, that he was never going to read. And my wife, said to me, she can't deal with him. Now, you have to remember something. This was exactly 1 week before the High Holy Days, you know, in the Jewish calendar. And my wife was a school administrator, and she was just opening school. So she was opening school. She was preparing for the holidays. She was busy cooking and cleaning, right? She said, I don't have any time for this. So she left it to me. And so she said, did you do Baruch's book order? I said, no, I didn't. She goes, you're not leaving the house until you do the book order. Well, I put my briefcase down, put my cup of coffee down, walked into my kitchen, proceeded to negotiate with my 8-year-old for the next 20 minutes. I whittled him down to 2 books. It felt pretty good.
Parenting.
Interestingly enough, the 2 books that he picked were from a series called Survivor.
Wow.
Yeah, when those books showed up a couple of weeks later, it sent a shiver down my spine. Unbelievable. Yeah. Now, here's the amazing thing, and you're going to see this throughout my story. That book order was actually due on Monday, the 10th. But my son left his pamphlet in school on Friday. So my wife wrote a note to the teacher asking if he can have an extra day, and she said sure, and she made sure to put the pamphlet into his knapsack. And he brought it home on Monday. And, you know, I ultimately didn't do it with him until that day. But if he would have brought that pamphlet home on Friday, I would have done it with him on Sunday. And at 8 o'clock in the morning on September 11th, I would have been sitting at my desk and you would be interviewing somebody else because I'd be dead.
Wow.
But because he left his pamphlet in school on Friday, I am here to tell you my story.
Goodness. Yep. Wow. But it'd be good to obviously go more into that and, you know, like what floor you were working on and, you know, what floor
we're
going
to get to all that. We're going to get to all that. This was just the beginning. All right.
Okay.
See, my story has all these types of coincidences throughout the story. And at the end of the day, I personally believe it was just the hand of God. I believe God was just looking out for me that day. All right. I couldn't come up with another rational reason. Anyway, so I signed the check, signed the tear sheet, put it into his knapsack, picked up my briefcase, picked up my cold cup of coffee, and out the door I go. And I am really, really ticked because that 20 minutes just cost me 40 minutes. Because the later you go into the city, the longer it takes. I didn't get to the Trade Center until 20 minutes to 9. My office was on the 101st floor. But you couldn't get to the 101st floor with one elevator. You had to take an express elevator to 78. And on 78, you would change to get another express elevator to the higher floors. So I'm waiting by the elevators. And the first elevator that came down on the lobby was all the way on the right side of the lobby. So I ran down to the end of the lobby, got into the elevator, went up to the 78th floor. When the doors opened on the 78th floor, I realized that the elevators that I needed to get to my office was all the way on the left side of the sky lobby, because that's what 78 was. It was just the sky lobby. It was just elevators, escalators. That was it. So I started to walk towards that bank of elevators. I must have been about 8 feet from that bank of elevators when, as best as I can describe, there was an explosion. The entire building shook. The lights went out, the place filled with smoke, and I was literally thrown off my feet. I thought a bomb had gone off in the elevator in front of me. That's how violently the building shook. I heard people yelling and screaming, fire in the elevator, and I'm thinking to myself, of course there's a fire in the elevator. A bomb just went off in there. That's what I thought. I had no idea. Now, I'm figuring, what to do, where to go, and I saw in between two of the banks of elevators, of the big elevators I just took up to get there, there was a light. So I figured since all the lights went out, it was probably an emergency light. I figured it's probably a good place to go. But there was a lot of smoke. And I remembered as a kid, what do they teach when there's a lot of smoke? You stay low to the ground, right? I literally crawled from where I was to that light. And I stood up and I'm looking around. I don't know where to go. I don't know what to do. I walk behind the bank of elevators and there's a door there. Sure enough, there was a security office behind those elevators. I never knew that. I had been working in that building for the better part of 8 years, never knew there was a security office on that floor. I walk into the security office and there is a guy who was the fire warden for the floor. And he is trying the landlines. The landlines were all dead. He's trying the cell phones, the mobiles. The mobiles were dead. Nothing. I looked at him. I said, what do we do? Where do we go? He looked at me and goes, I don't know. Of course, he didn't know. We had no idea what had happened. All we knew is that there was a bomb that went off in the building. That's what we knew. Or that's what we thought we knew. I got to figure a way to get out. I go back outside into the hall. When I get into the hallway, I bump into a coworker of mine. Her name was Virginia DiChiara. Virginia was on the elevator that I was about to get on when that plane hit. And as she described it to me, the doors had started to close and they jammed open about, you know, a foot, foot and a half. The walls of the elevator collapsed. The ceiling collapsed. There was a cable that snapped, was sparking in the elevator. The jet fuel came down the sides of the elevator, ignited by the spark, and there was a wall of fire. There were three people in that elevator: Roy Bell, Virginia, and Renee. Roy Bell was the first one to jump through that fire, and he suffered second-degree burns. Virginia jumped out right after him, and she suffered third-degree burns. And Renee, who was the last one out, she died from her burns. All in a space of 6, 8, 10 seconds, that was the difference between life and death that day, at least for these three people. Virginia sees it's just me. Ari, thank God, please help me. Whatever you do, please don't leave me. I'm in so much pain. I said to Virginia, I promise I will not leave you and we will get out of here. And here's another point of irony. Virginia and I were not good friends. She was an internal auditor and she had been hired the year before by Cantor, and the first department she audited was mine. Needless to say, she didn't give me very good marks. Okay. As a matter of fact, she almost got me fired.
Okay.
And there we were, she and I.
Life or death, absolutely.
I had a decision to make. Do I say the heck with you, lady, and, you know, get out and run out as fast as I could? Or do I say, you know, no problem, I'll help you? Well, I only knew the right thing to do, and that was to help her. And I said to Virginia, our past did not matter.
Yeah.
All right. She was another human being in trouble. I was the guy that God put there. All right. And I was going to do whatever it took to help her to get out of the building.
From God, I believe that was
100%.
Yeah, 100%.
That's why I said to you, you'll see throughout my story, right?
Okay.
All the different coincidences that happen.
Yeah. Sorry. I'm so sorry to cut in, but how was the breathing then? I mean, were you able to breathe?
We were able to breathe.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
You know, it was. Look, I know we were able to breathe, but I had what you call. I went to the doctor the next day because I had a very smoky taste in my mouth. I thought my lungs were burned. So I went to the doctor. He said, no, it's just residual smoke. Okay. So yeah, we were breathing in smoke. There's no doubt about it.
Oh, okay.
Okay. So I bring her into that office and all of a sudden the fire warden turns and says, okay, we can get out. Sterile on the left. Sterile on the left. I'll never forget those words. We came out of the office. I looked up and I saw a little sign. You know what it said? It was red and white. It said exit. In Europe, it's usually a little green man, right? Well, it said exit. And I, you know what? When I go into big buildings these days, every time I walk into a building, I look for those signs because I never know when it might save my life, because it certainly did that day.
Wow.
We followed the exit signs and we walked around a bend and some guy, we ran ahead and he opened the door and he goes, I found it. And I look inside the stairwell and I see there are lights on. So I figured that they're probably emergency lights because the lights went out in the building. So I turned to the people behind me. There was Roy Bell, myself, Virginia, and the fire warden. And there must have been about 6 or 8 other people with us. And I turned to the people behind me. I said, does anybody have a flashlight? Thinking to myself that if the lights go out, it'll be pitch black in there. So I turned around. I said, does anybody have a flashlight? Now, remember, this is before smartphones. So nobody get, no, give me a wisecrack about, oh, let's just take out your phone, flashlight. Yeah, no, we didn't have phones with flashlights. Okay, buddy. Anyway, so I turned around. I said, does anybody have a flashlight? And two people behind me, oh, yeah, we got flashlights. And I'll never forget thinking to myself, where did you get a flashlight from and why are you carrying it?
What's that about?
Right?
Yeah.
So, but I said, listen, people, if the lights go out, nobody panic. We will have light. The next thing I did was I looked down at Virginia's feet and I said, thank God she's wearing flats and not high-heeled shoes. Because I will tell you, there were high-heeled shoes all the way down in that stairwell. Women had just kicked them off to get down as fast as they could. So we were ready to start heading down. It was the fire warden, Roy Bell, myself, and Virginia. We walked in a line, and I told Virginia, if you feel faint, if you feel like you're going to fall forward, fall on me, and I'll carry you. And we started to head down. We got down three flights, 75th floor. But all of a sudden, as far as I'm concerned, one of the biggest miracles of the day happened to me, and the fact that I wasn't killed when the plane hit, my mobile rang. Now, most people go, yeah, so what? Well, remember, there was never reception in the Trade Center. And that, on that day, there was nothing working. I remember standing in my office by my window going, hello, can you hear me now? Can you hear me now? You know, couldn't get reception. So here we were. I'm in the middle of a stairwell, in the middle of a building, on a day that there was no reception whatsoever. And my phone rang. I picked up. I went, hello? It's my wife on the other end of that phone. And she was crying, and she's telling me something about a plane going into the building. I had no idea what she was talking about. I said to her, Joyce, I'm in a stairwell. I'm on the 75th floor. I'm on my way down. Now is not a good time. I said, I'll call you when I get out of the building. And I hung up the phone, not realizing, of course, it would be hours until I actually spoke to her again. We continued on down. Oh, so Roy Bell says to me, oh, Ari, can I use your phone to call my office? And of course, I handed him my phone. He dialed. He hit send. Nothing. Dead. I looked up and I said, thank you, God, because at least now I knew that my wife knew that I wasn't killed when the plane hit. So that was comforting.
Yeah. And also, you now know it's a plane and not a bomb.
Yeah. I know but you know, when she told me something about a plane, I thought it was like a little Cessna, a little Piper Cub, you know, one of those little itty bitty planes, because we always used to see them flying around, you know, beneath us.
Absolutely.
So we continued on down. We got down to the 50th floor, and Virginia says to me, Ari, I can't go on, can't do it. And my first instinct was, I'll have her sit down, we'll rest a little bit, and then we'll get up and keep going. And then I thought to myself, you know what? If she sits down, she may never get up. And if she doesn't get up, she is going to die. And that wasn't on my watch for the day. I wasn't going to let that happen. I said, no, Virginia, you can do this. And we poured the water. Somebody had, you know, bottles of Poland Spring water. We poured it on her arms to give her relief from the burns and poured it into her mouth to give her a drink. And now I'm counting the floors down. I'm coaching 45, 44, 42. You're doing great. You're doing great. And we were doing great until 38. 38 was backed up with people. See, the firefighters had stopped the people from going down because they were coming up. I'm getting really, really scared because she's in terrible shape. And I said, is there a paramedic in the building? As if you're a paramedic, I have a burn victim here. Please, we need help. But if not, please step to the right and let us through. And they did. Wow. People squeezed over as much as they could, and they literally opened the path so that we can continue going down.
Okay.
Yep. We got down on the first floor and the fire warden keeps going down. I said, where are you going? He goes, we got to get out through the garage.
Yeah.
I turned to Virginia. I said, we just came down 78 flights of stairs. What's another 4 or 5? And we started to head down. We got down 2 flights when all of a sudden the door on the first floor opens up and some guy yells out, where are you people going? I said, we're going out through the garage. He goes, no, you can't get out through the garage. You have to come back up here, come out through the first floor. I turned to Virginia. I said, we got to go back up 2 flights. Okay. She said a few things I can't say in mixed company.
Yeah.
Or in any company. And we headed back up.
Yeah. Oh, goodness.
Interestingly enough, what I found out later, there were people in that garage that never got out. Who was the guy who opened the door? I don't know, because I never saw him. And why did he pick that moment to open the door? I don't know. But that guy, when he yelled out, where are you people going? He saved our lives that day. You tell me.
Miracle.
So we get out. We're on the first floor in the lobby. And there are police and firefighters there. And they were telling us to go all the way through the mall, through the atrium. It was a long, long walk out of the buildings. We finally get out on Church Street. I stopped the cop and I said, where should we go? He goes, across the street in front of the Millennium Hotel. We're setting up a triage center there. There'll be ambulances there. Bring her there. And that's what I did. I brought her there. Sure enough, an ambulance pulls up. We help her into the ambulance. And now I breathe a sigh of relief, because at least now I know that she's getting medical attention. Up until that point, the only thing I could do is keep her spirits up. I couldn't help her medically, you know, but I needed to keep her spirits up. I turn around as I walk out of the ambulance and I look up at the buildings. There was a guy standing next to me. I looked at him and said, how did building two get on fire? And he looks at me like I'm crazy. He goes, what are you talking about? Two jetliners went into the buildings. They're calling it a terrorist attack. I look at him like he's crazy. What are you talking about? You see, I never heard that second plane. I certainly heard that first plane. Trust me. All right. The noise was deafening, but I never heard the second plane. People look at me with the same look that you're looking at me with. Right. The only thing I attribute it to is the fact that I was so focused on the task at hand. I had a job to do. Yeah. My life, Virginia's life, and I was tunnel vision. I blocked everything else out and we just kept going. I never heard that second plane.
That makes sense. Yeah.
So I walk over to the ambulance driver. I said, you know, why are you still here? Why aren't you leaving? He goes, we can't leave until we fill the ambulance. They were expecting a huge amount of casualties. So they weren't going to leave until they put 5, 6, 7 people into the ambulance. Virginia says to me, Ari, I can't do it. I can't take it. I'm going to faint. I says, Virginia, just hold on. Hold on. They finally fill the ambulance. The guy goes, okay, we're ready to go. I'm breathing a sigh of relief because as soon as that ambulance leaves, there's only one place I'm going. And that's back to those buildings. Because I'm looking for my friends. I'm looking for my coworkers. I'm looking to help. That's the only place I'm going. Once she's gone, and I know she's taken care of, I'm going back. So the guy goes, okay, we're ready to roll. Virginia turns to me, says to me, Ari, you're coming with us. Now, I don't want to say I was in a comfort zone, but the reality is I knew where I was. And if I needed to get someplace else, I would know how to get there from where I was. The thought of getting into that ambulance and going someplace else did not excite me. And I said to Virginia, you don't need me anymore. I'm going to get a hold of your mom and she's going to meet you at the hospital and you're going to be okay. She turns to the ambulance driver and she says, we're not leaving unless he comes with us.
Oh, boy.
I'm looking at the driver. He's looking at me. I see his eyes. He thinks this is not a cab service. I'm thinking this. I don't need a cab, you know. But I finally said to him, you know, maybe for our own psychological well-being, maybe I should just come. And he said, fine, hop into the front. I got into the front of that ambulance and we pulled away. We were one of only a few ambulances that actually got away from the scene that day. My friends who were volunteer ambulance services showed me pictures of crushed ambulances at the scene. They just never had a chance to get away. We were one of a few that actually got away. You know, Virginia thanks me every single day for saving her life, and I tell you, you got it all wrong. If she wouldn't have insisted that I get into that ambulance, I would have been standing at the base of that building when it came down. I'd be dead. There's no doubt in my mind. No doubt. But she insisted that I go with her.
Amazing.
The rest of the day was a very, very long day. There's a lot of happened. We don't have enough time on this podcast, but I will tell you this. I got home at 5:30 in the afternoon. There were 20 people in my living room and I had no less than 100 phone messages. And I know that because I had to return all those phone calls. And I remember back then it was a little micro cassette tape. It wasn't digital. It's a micro cassette tape. And I still have that tape. I have nothing to play it on, but I still have the tape.
That is amazing, yeah.
And I learned something very important that day. You have no idea how many friends you really have until they all think you're dead.
Okay. That is actually really true because I was actually in New York during that time as well. Again, I was holidaying. I was at the World Trade Center 3 days before it actually went down. You know, I was there visiting and exploring. But it's so strange because I had a stomach bug when I was at the World Trade Center. And you know, when you talk about signs, I actually couldn't go up. So my family went up and I had to stay down because I was just feeling so ill. And I went down, you know, because they had all of those kind of food parlors downstairs. underground, the World Trade Center, right. and I bought myself a nice kind of fruit smoothie. And, you know, I was chatting to loads of lovely Americans, you know, they all love my accent. And then, yeah, same with you. At the time, phones weren't really that popular. But what happened was, you know, I was stranded there for like 2 weeks. Like, you know, we went to Canada as well. We took like a bus to Canada just to kind of, you know, pass some time because we've got some relatives there. And then when I came back to England, I realized that my voice messages were full, had like 20 messages. You know, and I was thinking, wow, you know, people, like all my university friends at the time. Thinking, wow.
There you go.
Oh, wow. So I can't believe. So were you at the hospital all those hours then?
I was at the hospital with Virginia. I don't remember how long, but what I do remember is that they actually threw me out because I started to make noise because nobody was paying any attention to her. And they asked me, who are you? I said, who am I? He goes, yeah, are you a relative? I said, no. He goes, you have to leave. Hospital protocol. If you're not a relative, you can't stay. And they literally threw me out of the hospital. I turned to Virginia. I said, Virginia, I promise we're going to get a hold of your mom. She's going to meet you here and you're going to be okay.
Okay, that's good. Wow. And are you and Virginia really good friends now?
Oh, we've become very good friends. Yeah. We speak to each other every year on 9/11. We speak to each other. We actually exchange Christmas and Hanukkah presents. Every time, you know, she splits her time between New Jersey and Florida. Every time she comes up to the New York area, we go out, we have lunch, we have dinner, we have drinks, whatever it is. Yeah, we've become very, very good friends.
Oh, that's okay. So how about the consequences of that incident then? Because, look, it's a highly traumatic incident. And I totally understand when you said that, you know, you didn't actually hear the second plane. It's because you were in a state of shock, you know, and it's a fight and freeze response, which is like a traumatic response, which is totally understandable. But what were the implications of that? Because it's one of the most traumatic episodes that the whole world has ever seen.
Right. So what I will tell you is like this. Was I affected? I never believed I was, but I was. Mm-hmm. And one of the symptoms was literally for a month, all right, before I would leave my house in the morning, I would open the door and I'd look up and down the street to see if anybody was there. All right. Because I was paranoid. I thought they missed me in the Trade Center. They're going to find me and track me down here and they're going to kill me.
Personal lie. Okay. Yeah.
I was totally, totally paranoid. Mm-hmm. You know, it was just, and loud noises made me jump. Never happened to me before, but loud noises, especially, and even today, even to this day, all right, I hear a loud noise, I jump, all right? So, I definitely, when I look back on it, you know, I was a macho guy, you know, macho guys don't suffer from PTSD, you know?
Yeah, I get it.
I was a macho guy.
Yeah.
But the reality is that, but you know what? On the other side of the coin, I made some really, really life-changing decisions.
Okay.
All right. Mm-hmm. One of the biggest decisions that I made was that, you know, I used to fly off the handle at the drop of a hat. I used to get angry very, very quickly. I was a yeller. I was a screamer, whatever. And I decided that I wasn't going to do that anymore. I was going to control my anger. And the other thing I decided was I was not going to curse anymore. I wasn't going to swear. Right? Because you know what? Everybody thinks it's really cool to swear, you know, especially when you're growing up. It's really cool. You know, they drop an F-bomb and an S-bomb. Right? And I said, you know what? It's terrible. It just sounds terrible. And I said, I am not going to do this anymore. But here's the impact that had. Whenever there was a meeting going on and I was part of that meeting, nobody in that room would curse. Because they all knew that Ari Schoenbrunn doesn't curse. So nobody would curse. Nobody would swear. And in the event that somebody did by accident, the response was always the same. They'd go like, I'm sorry, please forgive me. I didn't mean it. Please forgive me. So because I made a decision, look at the effect that it had on the people around me.
Wow.
So those are some of the things that I did, you know. Well, you know, there were a lot of different things. You know, my kids, you know, I remember when I was working before 9/11, my kids used to say, "Daddy, can you come on a class trip? We're going to the zoo." I go, "No, Daddy's got to work." "You know, Daddy, can you come to the class play? I've got the lead role." "No, Daddy's got to work." "Can you come to mock trial? You know, that's after school, so that's after work, so you could be there, right?" "No, Daddy's got to work late." "Daddy's got to work. Daddy's got to work. Daddy's got to work." That was always the refrain until that day. After that day, Daddy's on the class trips. Daddy's at the school plays. Daddy's wherever his children and now grandchildren need him to be, because that is what is important. But always remember, and this is really important, there is a God above, and he's looking down, and he's watching, because he was watching me that day.
Yes, he was, absolutely. All those amazing coincidences, you know, just... It was your guides, you know, whatever you believe in, your angels, God. You were protected, and I just feel like that is such a blessing. In, you know, because look, in terms of stats and stuff, you know, I actually don't know the stats of the people that did survive compared to those who aren't with us anymore. God bless. But you know, you're a survivor.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I don't like being called a survivor, but, you know, at the end of the day, I've gotten used to it, you know, because I never liked it. You know, it was too Holocaust-y, you know.
Yeah.
I live for it through a day, not 4 years. You know what I'm saying? It's just like, so, but, you know, I live with it and I do the best I can. You know, and I try and help. And that's why I do speaking. That's why I do public speaking. All right. Because I don't want people to forget what happened that day. And I want people to understand that there's a lesson to be learned here. And, you know, I always say 9/11 was a tragedy. But if we don't learn something from it, it's twice the tragedy.
Yeah. What do you think is a big learning experience from that for the whole world?
I think that God was sending us a message.
Okay.
I think that the world as we know it was not a good place, not to say that it's a good place today because it's in worse shape today than it was back then. But back then, the world was not in good shape. And I took the message that I took out from it was you need to make some changes. And you'll start with yourself. Make the changes that you need to do, and then you'll see the effect that it has on other people. I'll give you a very, very a nice little lesson here that I use in my talks. Okay. Picture, I don't think I told this to you, but picture this. Picture an audience of 500 people in a room. Okay. And what they do is they black out the shades so it's pitch dark in the room. Everybody's holding a candle, not lit. I'm holding a candle and I light my candle. Okay. A little bit of light. Yep. Not a whole lot. Now, what do? I walk over to the person in the first row, the first seat, and I light their candle. Now, is there twice as much light? Yeah. Is it a lot? No. Is my candle diminished in any way? No. Right. And then the second person lights and third and fourth and fifth and sixth, and you light, you light, you light, you light. And it's before you know it, you know what we've done? We've lit up a room. We've lit up a room because that candle represents the change in the decision that we made to become better people. So what have we done? Because we made that decision, we've lit up a room. And then you go outside the room and you light up the town and you light up the city and you light up the country and you light up the world. But it's got to start with you.
I love that. And I can see you're just a natural speaker. Like, have you always been so natural?
I don't know.
And it'd be great for you to tell my listeners as well, you know, what you're doing today. Tell us about your podcast.
Oh, so today I'm still doing my speaking. Mm-hmm. The world is opening up. Conferences are back in style again, you know, in-person conferences. So I'm starting to do a lot of motivational speaking again. I'm doing my podcast, which is called Whispers in Bricks. And it's all about overcoming adversity, the stuff that people go through. I mean, you know, everybody has a 9/11 story that they've gone through, right? And everybody thinks when they're going through it that they're the only ones going through it. The reality is it's not true. There are thousands of people going through it. They just need to hear it and need to know it so that they're not all alone. And I have my coaching business. That, you know, I use my experience from 9/11, my Wall Street experience, in order to help people overcome different situations that they're going through, whether it's trauma, whether it's, you know, getting stuck, whether it's, you know, being in a job that you hate, whether it's a relationship, whatever it is. Okay. I help guide people to, you know, get through that situation, whatever that situation is. So it's called Whispers and Bricks Coaching Academy or Performance Coaching. And my podcast is Whispers and Bricks. And my motivational speaking is called Miracles in Fate on 78.
Wow. Okay. And so where can they find you? Are you on all the socials?
I'm on the social medias. Facebook, LinkedIn, just type in Ari Schoenbrunn, like LinkedIn. I'm not really that much on Instagram because I just don't do that. I'm on Twitter, but not a lot. And of course, you can always get me on my website, arischoenbrunn.com. That's arischoenbrunn.com. That's where you find me about my speaking business, or you can go to whispersandbricks.com and that'll take you to my podcast page. There's a place to subscribe. I invite everybody to come and subscribe. There's a contact piece over there that if you want to get a hold of me, you can do it through that. You can do it through the social media. You can email me, ari@arischoenbrunn.com.
Brilliant. And tell us about the meaning behind your podcast. So why is it called Whispers and Bricks?
Why is it called Whispers and Bricks?
Okay.
No, you didn't. No, you didn't. It's called Whispers and Bricks because very often one of the stories, I'm a big storyteller, in case you haven't noticed. I'm a big storyteller.
I like it.
And one of the stories I tell is about a young executive was climbing the ladder of success, 35 years old. He goes out and he buys himself a brand new Jaguar. And he's driving through the city streets, and maybe he's going a little too fast on the city streets, and he sees some kids darting in and out. And as he passes by, all of a sudden, bam, his car gets hit by a brick. So he slams on the brakes, he puts the car in reverse, he pulls back, he jumps out of the car, he grabs this kid and said, why did you do that? Why did you throw the brick in that car? Look at that dent. You know what that's going to cost me to fix? It's a brand new Jaguar. And the little boy goes, please, mister, please, I didn't know what to do. You see, my older brother fell out of his wheelchair and I couldn't pick him up and I couldn't get anybody to stop. He says, tell me where your brother is. And he takes him by the hand and they walk down to the end of the block. And sure enough, in the street, there's an overturned wheelchair and a little boy in the street. So he takes the wheelchair and he makes it right side up and he picks up the boy and he puts him in the wheelchair. He takes out his handkerchief and he wipes away the blood from the scratches. And the little boy starts wheeling his brother away. And he says, thank you, mister. Thank you so much. And this young executive walks back to his car very slowly with a lump in his throat. He looks at the dent and he vows never, ever to fix it because he never wants to forget what happened. You see, they say that God whispers to our minds and he whispers to our hearts. But we're so busy running through life, just like that guy was running through the dent, so busy running through life that we don't pay attention to the whispers. So you know what happens? Every so often, God throws a brick at us to wake us up. Now, me, I've had the brick thrown at me. That was 9/11. You have a choice. You can listen to the whispers, or you can wait for the brick. Hence, Whispers and Bricks.
That is so powerful. That's the first time you told me that in that detail. So thank you so much. Wow. That was really meaningful. And I think just today, the talk with you has been really meaningful. It's really touched my soul because you know, obviously being there to kind of experience the atmosphere, you know, in New York during that time, it was horrendous. It was just, it was a tragedy for the whole world. And you know, I'm so glad that you're here to now inspire people and to help people to overcome their own, you know, fears and beliefs. And I just think it's amazing the work that you're doing. So thank you.
Well, thank you so much for having me. I hope your audience has gained something, a little something out of this.
Absolutely.
And it was my pleasure coming on. And I, you know, I'm happy. Yeah. I'm happy that I was able to do this.
Amazing. Thank you so much. So listeners, we hope you found this inspirational, and please do get in touch with Ari or myself if you have any questions about the episode, or if you'd like to find out more about Ari, then connect with him. I will be adding all the links in the description of this talk. So that's the end of our talk today. Until next time, stay blessed, stay empowered, and keep shining your light.
Thanks for tuning in to today's episode of Victim to Victor. Subscribe so you don't miss out on new episodes. And be sure to follow the podcast on socials to keep updated on what's next, and share Victim to Victor with family and friends to help grow the community and spread the positive healing energy.